Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We are doing this the day after the formal beginning of the Senate impeachment trial, and I have a piece up on the Bulwark, you know, how to capture the moment. You have the pomp and ritual, the formal readings of the article, the swearing in of the Chief Justice, the administering of the oath, which no senator actually intends to keep. And of course, the president, leaning hard on the shift key, tweets out, "I just got impeached for making a perfect phone call." And what I wrote in the Bulwark today is this is, in so many ways, the moment that Trump has brought us to. This mind-bending mixture of high drama and low farce. You know, it's a moment of historical weight blended with this cartoonish absurdity. It's a little bit like The Sopranos if it was directed by Judd Apatow. So speaking of high seriousness and a good deal of snark, we are joined by political guru Mike Murphy, who is also the co-host of the podcast Hacks on Tap. So thanks for joining me this morning, Mike.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me, Charlie. I enjoy the Bulwark, and I'm happy to be here.
So tell me about the Hacks on Tap. You do this with David Axelrod, and you post it every week. When?
Well, normally it comes up Tuesday afternoon, so occasionally something will happen in the campaign that will cause us to delay it a day or two. Like this week, it was the debate. We were up on Wednesday. The story of it is that Axelrod and I, despite the fact we agree on very little other than, I guess, Trump these days, are old friends going way back to early in our careers. We used to run races against each other all over the country. But we have a friendship under the theory that your political opponent is not your enemy, and we're quite close in real life. So for a long time, we'd have these conversations about what do you think is going on in politics. And one day, yeah, we'd have them a lot. And one day, Axe called me and said, "Hey, why don't we turn this into a podcast?" And I said, "Sure," because I had done Radio Free GOP, which I stopped after 16 on the theory of give the president a little room to, you know, impress us all. That was, of course, a foolish idea. And so I was thinking of bringing Radio Free GOP back, which I might. But anyway, we started Hacks on Tap middle of last year, and it's doing great. And, you know, it's two old political pros talking about what's really going on in the campaign, like a bar conversation in a campaign trail, you know, hotel or something. And we have a lot of fun with it.
It seems so old fashioned to not regard your political opponent as an enemy of all that is good and true. Somebody who hates God, hates America, and who you are morally obligated to destroy. It's kind of anachronistic, isn't it?
It's totally anachronistic. Back when we had the definition overall as Americans, not as members of a tribe. You know, Bill Gray, the congressman from Philadelphia, had a great saying 20 years ago that I have ripped off and I use all the time because I think it's so dead on accurate. But our politics are getting to the place where the equation is, I'm right, you're evil.
Yeah.
And if you're evil, I can do or say anything to you because I'm fighting evil. And it leads to this corrosive madness now that in the long run, nobody wins except maybe our enemies.
And it's been a long time coming. Okay, so let's dive right into this because I'm particularly obsessed with trying to figure out what's going on with Senator Martha McSally, who's walking in the halls of the Senate. She's asked this very basic question by CNN reporter Manu Raju. Is that how you pronounce his name?
Who,
as far as I can tell, is widely respected on both sides of the aisle. And he asked her this straightforward question: should the Senate consider new evidence as part of the impeachment trial? And she answers, "Manu, you're a liberal hack. I'm not talking to you. You're a liberal hack." And then she was so proud of this, she posts it on her Twitter account. She starts raising money off of it, and she does a victory tour on Fox News. So, Mike Murphy, give me your take on this, because, you know, Martha McSally, like, seemed like 5 minutes ago was kind of a respectable figure, former fighter pilot, reasonable human being, and now is channeling some sort of inner Trump type thing. So what's going on here?
Well, it is Kafkaesque. I have a theory about it. So to give her a little backstory, she had a very impressive career in the military as a pilot. She ran for Senate and lost. The Republican governor and world there said, "Hey, we've got to appoint somebody to the McCain seat So, hey, we'll get the, she seems like a decent candidate, even though she lost last time. Let's appoint her. So she's an appointed senator. And I had some respect for her based on her biography. I think a lot of people did. She suffers from the same disease as 95% of her colleagues in the Senate, which is a complete gutless cowardice about Trump, because she's got her eye on a reelect coming up and primary voters and all the other, you know, instincts that would have made the Republican Senate caucus essentially useless on Anzio Beach. But here we are. And then this moment happens where Raju, who, by the way, is a respected, he's one of the guys, there are these reporters whose beat is the Congress and the Senate. And because of the way the Senate works, so they're trying to clamp down on this during the trial, it is quite easy to buttonhole senators and ask them questions. And, you know, fair enough, that can be irritating. But he has a particularly kind of just the facts vibe. He's not a bad guy. I'm sure in the cloakroom they roll their eyes. How do I get to my office without 10 questions from Manju or some of his colleagues? But hey, that's life in the Senate. It goes with the free haircuts or the cheap haircuts. So anyway, there we are having a typical day. He throws the most basic question of the day. What about witnesses? Which is where the political fight is going to be, especially for her, Cory Gardner, Susan Collins, Republicans who have very tough reelects and are, you know, would like to have some way to have some cover on being called complete Trump apologist. And she does this ridiculous, you know, you're a liberal hack, you're a liberal hack. Now, by the way, senators get to be cranky. If an hour later she'd apologized or something, it would be a very different deal. Instead, she fetishized it. She went out there on Fox. They have a T-shirt, all this stupid grassroots fundraising trickery, which, by the way, just to put a cherry on top of this, was stupid, not only in destroying her reputation and all the other collateral damage I believe she did to herself, including in her election, but Mark Kelly now is going to have a surge in his fundraising that net-net will probably be equal or greater than hers. So if the brilliant political ploy here was to make a fool out of herself publicly to somehow find another $800,000 in online contributions to have an advantage over Kelly, well, congratulations, because my guess is Kelly will get $1 million. Including, I sent him a contribution, and I do not like to give to Democrats. I'm a conservative, but I thought of my old boss, McCain, and I thought of her cowardice.
She's filling
on
his
Trump
seat.
And,
so
I snapped and sent him a little bit of money.
Yeah. Well, Tim Miller has a piece up where he refers to this as pulling a Stefanik. And, you know, the strategy does seem to be that if you want to, you know, stay in good graces with the base, if you don't want to necessarily go full out defending Trump, just attack the media, just lash out at the media. It is a safe and an easy play to do this. And this is what Tim Miller writes. He said, they all know that Trump is guilty. The only question is whether or not they can avoid admitting this out loud before they vote to acquit him. And I guess beating up on reporters is a good substitute. It's a way of changing the subject while signaling your loyalty.
Yeah, it's an applause line. You know, it's what the people in the sainted business of professional wrestling would call cheap heat. And, you know, it is so that the problem, the despair and all this going on for those of us like you have been in the conservative trenches for a long time and actually thought it meant something. The world has kind of imploded upon itself. We're in Republican land. Now, every Republican candidate treats the general election as just a Republican primary.
Yeah.
So everybody's trapped in the Republican primary, which is bad enough. But then on top of that, the Republican primary universe itself, the bulk of it, not all, you know, there's a third of Republican primaries who are not on board all this stuff, but two thirds of them have folded into crazy town. So, you know, this thing is collapsing in on itself, which is never any political scientist who studied history and the empirical evidence of campaigns and elections will tell you this is not a good thing. It's not a sign of strength. This is bunker mentality. And short term, it's having a huge impact because it's giving Trump kind of a force field against reality and you know, the things he's done. But long term, it is a hollowing out of the party, which is going to turn it into a husk, and we're going to lose seats. We're going to lose power. And I'm to the point now where it kills me to say it, but I think we deserve to.
Well, that moment yesterday, her petulant hackery just sort of did seem to, you know, capture this moment. You know, you have the historic moment of the impeachment trial, and then you have other Republican senators gibbering on about the pens as if people haven't been handing out pens forever. And then you have this sort of attack. And it sort of reminds you how Donald Trump trivializes and diminishes everything, because you know he's diminished the presidency and now it's the Senate's turn. If he can't dominate it, he will be clown it. And you would normally think that there'd be an institutional pride. Again, speaking of things that are anachronistic and archaic. Okay, speaking of the trial, we got the news just this morning that the president has this kind of what I'm sure that he regards as an all-star defense team, including Ken Starr, Alan Dershowitz, Pam Bondi, another guy who was involved in the Whitewater investigation. These are pretty big names. And so your just initial reaction, I mean, I think a lot of people thought it was going to be, you know, the Jim Jordans of the world. And at least there are like real lawyers, but lawyers with a certain amount of baggage.
Yeah, no, in all cases. And I want to talk about that, but I want to hang one more lantern on McSally because I'm so irate about it. And to your point about it, Trump is like a super virus who goes into every organism and reduces it to its lowest kind of mush. McSally going on the Laura Ingraham show to complain about media hackery when that is the core hive of, you know, selling out any kind of journalism, the opinion world of Fox. Now, it exists in other places in the media. It's not just Fox, but the irony of that is neck snapping. But to your point about the legal dream team, and they've all got PR teams, particularly Dershowitz. It'll just add to the circus atmosphere of this, but I don't think it'll change the fundamental dynamic of the trial, which is also the big political problem. If you're a cynical Republican, you say, okay, this is just another obstacle to get through. Who cares about rule of law and all that? What you want to do is a Clintonian strategy of letting a little of the air out, which is a measure to censure, some sort of Trump admission of, oh, I was having a long day. I probably was a little, you know, a little too abrupt with the Ukrainian president, didn't mean it that way. And oh, that Rudy, that was a mistake. You know, let the air out. So you give the Cory Gardners in Colorado, the McSallys in Arizona, potentially others, somewhere to move politically without having to vote the wrong way on impeachment. Instead, Trump's just going to want his legal team, who he will orchestrate in the old Stalin trick, to each compete against each other to suck up to him. To put on this show where the only witness he's interested in is Sean Hannity. I'm surprised Judge Judy didn't make the legal team, by the way. And, you know, he'll admit no guilt and just want to attack everybody, which really puts the senators who have some political vulnerability here, if there are a few, the majority could very much be in play, under great pressure because he's not giving them any room to move. So I think the real story of the trial for a political observer is going to be that tension between the smart, cynical way to get Trump out of this, which is where McConnell is, and the dumb, emotional, toddler, tantrumy performance that Trump will demand from his surrogates. And that friction is going to be a thing.
It will be. Now, I could make the cheap shot, which I'm going to do anyway.
About, sure, go for it.
Alan Dershowitz, of course, you know, gives us that perfect storm, gives us the Jeffrey Epstein angle on impeachment. So there's something for everybody here. But apparently, Dershowitz says he's going to argue that abuse of power and obstruction of Congress are not high crimes and misdemeanors that deserve impeachment. Interestingly enough, Justin Amash tweeted out, in other words, Dershowitz will argue the exact opposite of the position of the framers of the Constitution. So
right, and he's going to argue guilt but non-relevant guilt, and I don't think Trump's on board the guilt part.
Well, that's it. Yes, it's got to be perfect. It is the perfect phone call. There is no misconduct. There is nothing. So, you know, Dershowitz has got to rethink that because he can't say that this was an abuse of power or an obstruction of Congress because that does imply some sort of culpability.
Right. Right. Which is why there'll be a new Dershowitz in 3 days. Because, again, the president, if you read The Washington Post today, I'm sure you've seen the clip about the from the Rucker book about the meeting in the Pentagon.
I want to get to that next. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. We will. I mean, but clearly this guy is semi-stable and he has a reaction cycle of about 10 minutes on whatever's going on that moment and doesn't think strategically. So Dershowitz is doomed.
Okay. Let's do talk about that because I'm also obsessed about that. You mentioned John McCain a little bit earlier and, you know, I mean, how many times have we thought, you know, what would John McCain have to say about this? This book by Carol, how do you pronounce your name? Leonig? I don't want to.
You know, I can't pronounce it either.
Okay,
I know Phil Rucker. I don't know her.
Right. But I want to make sure she gets credit. I mean, there have been so many books written about the Trump era, and they basically all, you know, line up. But this one has the dazzling details. And and the dazzling detail that's reported today is this meeting that took place at the Pentagon in this this room called the Tank, which looks like apparently you know, small corporate boardroom, but it is one of the most important, quasi-sacred rooms for the military. You know, you have, you know, the picture of the peacemakers, the painting that depicts, you know, Civil War strategy session with Abraham Lincoln on the wall. So this is, the scene is 6 months into the administration, and all the bigs are there. Jim Mattis, Secretary of Defense, you know, the director of the National Economic Council, Gary Cohn back then, Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, and they're all meeting with all the flag officers, and they're trying to convince the president of the value of our alliances and give him a little bit of background about the world situation and history. And of course, the president wasn't having it. It gets ticked off. And he goes off on this angry rant where he basically says that the generals are a bunch of losers and babies and just, you know, going on and on and on, and just sounds like it was just, and it was dumbfounding. He says, I don't think the generals know how to win. You're a bunch of, you know, you're a bunch of et cetera. And the way it's described, you know, that he's, you're a bunch of dopes and babies. For a president known for verbiage he euphemistically calls locker room talk, this was the gravest insult he could have delivered to these people in this sacred space. The flag officers in the room were shocked. Some staff began looking down at their papers, rearranging folders. A few considered walking out. They tried not to reveal their revulsion on their faces, but questions raced through their mind. How does the commander-in-chief say that, one thought? What would our worst adversaries think if they knew he said this? It's an amazing moment.
Yeah, I read it this morning and I was physically sick. And to add a little context to it, what, according to their reporting, which I trust, the senior military people were stunned before that at what an ignoramus Trump was. Yeah. So they thought, we got to put on school here. You know, England is a ally that contributes to NATO that helps starve off the Russians and the Atlantic Alliance. So they put on this idiot school for Trump that was kind of camouflaged as a briefing. And Trump bucked and went crazy at the beginning because some of the facts they presented, basic things that, you know, most high schoolers know, ran afoul of his worldview of other countries are all chiselers who are ripping us off on our bases. And, you know, he kept throwing tantrums. And at the end, the big money quote for me was, I would never go to war with you people.
Yeah, right.
And that is such an insult. I'm just disappointed there wasn't a historical general like a Chesty Puller to stand up and say, you son of a bitch, and just chew out that toddler in chief we have of the Corporal Bone Spurs on that point. You know, that would have been, I think, a heroic defense of the institution of the U.S. military. But they were so stunned by his ignorance, rage, and barbarism and lack of respect. That room is where decisions that lead to casualties, big casualties, wars have been made, you know, going back in American history. And he just showed no respect for the institution or the professionals at all. You read that story today more than any clip I have seen in the history of the Trump presidency to know what the problem is, at least to me.
You know, and as you point out, you know, somebody who had evaded service because of the bone spurs, you know, insulting these generals, many of whom had these rich and storied combat careers. Well, interestingly enough, in this reporting, the one guy that did stand up was Rex Tillerson, who did not really distinguish himself as Secretary of State. But according to this, you know, he's looking around and he says, no, that's just wrong. Mr. President, you're totally wrong. None of that is true. And he said, the men and women who put on a uniform don't do it to become soldiers of fortune. That's not why they put on a uniform and go out and die. They do it to protect freedom. There was silence in the tank. Other military officers were grateful. This is the after this meeting was the one where Tillerson, and this has been reported in the past, came out and said he's a fucking moron, which of course got back. And this probably was the end of his working, you know, viable relationship with Trump. So at least Rex Tillerson
good
had
for
that
him.
Moment. But you make the interesting point. This is a long time ago. And the reluctance of other people to speak up and say, look, this is what's going on. You need to know this. And it's wrong. You know, as much as I admire people like Jim Mattis and others, they haven't done that, have they?
I agree. And I think they owe the country more than leaks to reporters. And in this case, I think it's Bannon. I think he's, for some reason, he's decided to play back his point of view from all the experiences he had. But there is, and we have a presidential election now, so there could come a moment, I think it's overdue, where they owe it to the country to express their frank view. I really think they do. You can't use traditional institutional conduct of silence and quiet respect in the crisis we're in now if the president doesn't play by those rules. You know, former presidents who would misbehave could be curbed by the weapon of shame. Trump is immune to the weapon of shame. So the normal kind of elite playbook of ways to react to a president's bad behavior is totally devalued in the devaluing universe of Donald Trump. So new problem, new kind of psycho in the White House requires new tactics, which means speaking the hell up. And I think they're all they've been disappointing on that. And they ought to give up the passive dignity and get in the fight.
Well, I agree with you. But there's so much cognitive dissonance going on here, including, you know, Trump has been successful in sort of wrapping himself in the mantle of, you know, commander in chief, you know, as a supporter of the military. And he's up until now has had strong support, you know, within at least the rank and file of the military. I may be wrong about that. At this point, but what comes through again and again is his fundamental contempt for the military, or at least its values. You know, this lecturing, you know, to these veterans that are a bunch of dopes and babies. His enthusiasm for war crimes. The way he regards the military as a is sort of, you know, transactional. You know, folks that go out and ought to be paid for all of this. There is, on the one hand, this sort of, you know, false bravado where he wants to be associated with the military and preside over military parades. And then there is this deep contempt for the actual values of the military.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that he is, to his core, an unfit commander in chief because he does not understand why the American citizen soldier fights a war.
Yes.
For purposes not just that, you know, the Juan Perón sitting in the Oval Office feels like invading somewhere or uses them as some Praetorian guard to go enforce his will with force, but they fight for a cause and purpose in the American idea. Not all that stuff is alien to Trump. So he doesn't understand why they're just not kind of a mercenary appliance to be used to his whim. I'm sure he's quite upset that, you know, unlike the German army in the old days, the American officers take an oath to the Constitution, not to the president. But, you know, with his kind of dictatorial instincts and his massive ignorance, this is somebody I don't think has ever read a history book in his life. He sees the military as just kind of like a trained German shepherd to do what he tells it and the way he tells it. So if he wants to go bomb historical sites in Iran, because that is what his former golf caddy / Twitter author wanders into the White House and pitches them, you know, let's do it. And they just follow orders. So if we ever were in war with Trump, I think he would be an extremely unfit commander in chief because he fundamentally doesn't understand how a citizen army in a democracy operates and the need to have some moral weighting to what we ask them to do.
See, that's what made what happened with Iran so difficult to deal with, because I think that it was a good thing that we went after General Soleimani. I think the world is better off without him. I think that was a defensible position. However, you know, with Donald Trump as commander in chief, you have to wonder, what was the strategy? What was the plan? You know, is this nation going to follow Donald Trump into war? Is, right. You know, this is when credibility and character matters fundamentally in a commander in chief. So you can defend the specific decision while still being deeply alarmed at where he's taking the country.
Yeah. I mean, look, on a tactical point of view, there's a lot of upside to the Soleimani thing. The problem is that it starts a slow ladder that we haven't really seen the consequences of. So we're going to need a year or two to find out if we're net ahead or behind on this. It's not a tit for tat of military operations. In fact, the Iranians know that, so they essentially de-escalated the thing because they know a frontal military conflict is so asymmetrical, it's a loser for them. But they have a huge Inspector Gadget, you know, book of asymmetrical tricks that they can start slowly unwinding that could be a real problem, and net we could be in a weaker position. But the larger point is, if the thing had escalated, I just don't think Trump understands what an American commander in chief does and what the role of the president is. So he would have then, you know, obviously been a weak one and therefore a dangerous one.
All right, let's talk about Lev Parnas for a moment.
Sure.
And this sort of cloud of sleaze and stupidity that the president surrounds himself with. And I'm continually struck by the way in which the president seems to attract the worst people in the world and empowers them. Now, whether or not Lev Parnas is credible, and I think the fact that he has documents would certainly add some credibility to him, although I think skepticism is certainly warranted. But the bottom line is, though, that here's a president who lectures our flag officers, calling them dopes and babies, but trusts people like Lev Parnas and Rudy Giuliani in these very, very sensitive issues. You know, what does that say about his presidency and about his judgment of character?
Well, my, you know, therapy a dog in all this is Twitter. So I'm constantly at Murphy Mike blasting out rage-filled tweets. And half the Trump tweets, at least that I send out, I always put, you know, hashtag dregs. Because since the campaign, there have been people that Trump hires that I wouldn't put to work in an Applebee's kitchen and the dishwashing line. It was actually a joke during 2016.
It's not a joke anymore. You're serious.
That's the nightmare of it, because we were all laughing about some of these clowns who get hired. You know, international relations expert Sam Clovis out in Iowa, who had, you know, been around Republican politics, but nobody was ever interested in. But Trump showed up and there was nobody left. And so we got kind of these fools who instantly, 90% of them anyway, they turned into yes men, and they just kind of hover around and pretended there was a campaign and took the money, which is why most of them were there. And so he's just been a drag magnet ever since. In fact, there's another. Today is a banner day in the Washington Post. They've got a great story about that horrid hotel that I'm proud I've never stepped foot in and never will. And how, like a Star Wars bar scene, they're all hanging around with Rudy as kind of the king drag. And you know, and it's just this cast of oafish clowns, and you know, it's like an old, what Mencken used to write these great run-on sentences about, a team of chiselers, pinchers, twisters, hatchet men, fuglemen, you know, slime under door slippers and midnight peepers would, you know, walk into the political convention. And it's exactly that. It's unbelievable. And the best thing of the story is, in paragraph like 20, they say that Rudy used to walk out on his bar tab all the time. Because he thought he owed the place. I know some sycophantic staffer is going to slip that to Trump today, and he'll be ranting for an hour and a half. He'll be NATO online, too. Tell him I'll call back. Rudy stiffed me on a margarita at my goddamn hotel. I want revenge. You know, it is a horrible, horrible cartoon of almost sick comedy. And the epicenter of the hive is at that horrible, horrible place.
See, this makes me think. We've been using the Star Wars bar scene now for several decades. You know, a couple of years from now, we'll be talking about, like, it's a scene from the Trump Hotel. It's like the Trump Hotel bar. You know, as the new analogy of that.
And the other thing is, they're not only grifters, but they're third rate grifters. I mean, if you're going to run an international con ring, at least bring in the professionals.
Rate. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm kind of offended by that. It's bad enough they're all con men, but at least get some professionals. I want to see Kid Twist in there. But instead, you got these Ukrainian thugs. And of course, it's a comedy of errors. And I just worry it becomes the new normal, that every next president is going to think, I need some dregs. And it'll be a dreg boom.
Oof. Okay, now speaking of dregs, I want your insight into all of this, because I'm actually trying to figure out what the dynamic here is. That as you watch the Senate prepare, I would argue that three of the worst Republicans, three of the most sycophantic spear carriers for the president would be, and you could, there's a lot of candidates here.
I was going to say, this is a fair fight. Yeah.
Lindsey Graham, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz. Now, as you know, what they all have in common is they all ran against Donald Trump, were beaten by Donald Trump in the primary. Is losing to Donald Trump in a primary, is it some kind of a distinctive, soul-crushing experience? Because when you run back the tape of what they said about him at one time, and then to watch the slavish, you know, butt-kissing that's going on right now, what is it about, you know, Graham, Cruz, and Paul that makes them so servile?
Yeah, no, it's unbelievable. It's like some canine anthropology thing where the dog has to get on the ground and put its hoofs in the air and surrender or its paws. You know, these are all crazy theories. I have a different theory about Cruz and Lindsay than I do about Rand Paul. I think Rand Paul is a believer. It's kind of a crank philosophy you can put on a 3x5 card, which is generally risky in life. But his crank philosophy is based on isolationism. Trump has stupid isolationist tendencies. So I think he sees a path to influence that he's never had before because he's been off in kind of his own corner. But I think he believes his stuff on isolationism, and Trump is therefore kind of a useful idiot from his point of view. Not that he can't get into useful idiot territory himself on occasion. So yeah, maybe that's the point of bonding.
He was like a libertarian. I agree. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when the Pauls were the cranks in the party that you had to worry about. You know, these were the wing nuts, and of course, it got a lot worse than that. But he was kind of a libertarian, and you know, Justin Amash was not necessarily a Paulite, but I mean, obviously also a libertarian. He's made a completely different decision about Trump than Rand Paul.
Yeah, I think Amash has a certain political purity and kind of like a lot of super ideological people in one thing, libertarianism in this case. He's not really that interested in his political career. He's interested in the big idea. And I think Rand Paul's kind of a discounted version of that, who, unlike his father, is a little more of a practical politician and therefore probably is watching the primary voters. But Cruz and Lindsay are, I think, battleship dreadnought class cynics. And I mean, I know Lindsay. He's an old friend of mine. He's broken my heart because he knows. But he decided, a friend of mine who knows him well too said, because we were texting back and forth about Jesus, Lindsay. And he said, look, he just doesn't want to spend the rest of his life in the bar he grew up in back in South Carolina. You know, he's kind of doing the Fritz von Papen thing where, don't worry, I can control him. I'll suck up to him, but I'll have influence and I'll outwit him. Well, when the Syria thing came down, which punctured everything Lindsay believes in U.S. foreign policy, I think it was a market moment for Lindsay to find out that all this influence he sold his soul to allegedly have with Trump is non-existent. It's worthless. So nothing left but toady now.
Well, okay. Yeah, but he didn't register. He didn't back off, say, wow, you know, I sold my soul for this. And right, I wasn't even in the room when you decided to abandon the
curves. Yeah, I think it just stripped away the argument. Okay. Now, pure toady. President wants a chocolate milkshake. Snap, snap. And, you know, that's the price he wants to pay not to lose the South Carolina primary, which is, you know, a line I've been using for 3 years that's kind of catching on. I heard Schmidt say it on TV the other day, which is, you know, we're not asking these guys to land on Anzio Beach, you know, but apparently, you know, doing what a senator ought to do is too much now because nothing beats winning a Republican primary and cheap haircuts and a lot of people calling you senator. It is absolutely heartbreaking, and Lindsay's the cutting edge of that. And, you know, again, I knew the good Lindsay, and I'm glad I haven't spoken to him in a couple of years because I don't even want to know this Lindsay.
Wasn't it Steve Schmidt who said he was like a pilot fish that, you know, he was when John McCain was around, he was able to follow in his wake. And when McCain disappears, he needs to follow another big fish because he is that pilot fish. And he just basically switched from McCain to Trump.
Well, I don't quite agree with that because the big power payoff during the McCain kind of lean years in the Senate where Lindsay around was not huge popularity. And Lindsay can be ornery and stick up for his stuff. I think it's more that Lindsay has to feel like he's a player inside whatever's happening now. And it was in the McCain kind of foreign policy semi-insurrection with the surge and everything against conventional thinking, moments like that. Of course, McCain was a great personality and Lindsay liked being around him. But now I think it's purely he wants to be one of the few people who thinks that he's a real player inside Trump world and wields that power with the secondary benefit of I'm going to get reelected to South Carolina where I always have to keep an eye on a primary. Now, Cruz, I think, is pure cynicism. It's like literally you could melt him down into cynic tablets that could change a whole country if you put him in the water supply. So I think Cruz is looking at Texas primary politics. He's looking at future presidential runs, and he's playing the most cynical possible game.
Yeah, I'm actually sitting here in my study while we're doing this, looking at a picture of me standing next to Ted Cruz, and I keep it up on the walls just sort of as a you know symbol of humility. Just remember putting all your faith in any of these guys. Oh, so Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio seems to be, you know, little Marco seems to be shrinking in front of our very eyes. And I say this as somebody that once thought that he was. I bought the stuff about that Marco Rubio was going to be the savior of the Republican Party, that he was the future of it. And it turns out that he is a pretty small guy, isn't he?
Yeah, you know, I've known him a long time. I'll tell a Rubio story here I've never said publicly, because I still get angry tweets from what I call Rubio helicopter moms, who fundamentally argue that the job of Jeb's campaign was to clear a path for Rubio Cruz. Mm-hmm. And so in our super PAC, the fact is that we didn't spend all our time, you know, trying to help them instead of what we did do, which was try to help Jeb, which is including be critical of Rubio, was some big sin against against America. So, but I've known Marco a long time. I was one of his first federal donors when he ran for Senate in a very uphill race against Charlie Crist. And we were all for him. I mean, mm-hmm. I think in some ways, if it hadn't been for Jeb Bush, he'd still be on the West Miami City Council. But Marco had a lot of good to him. And you could see that natural talent, and Marco believed the right stuff. I mean, mm-hmm. I was a big Marco fan, and I'll never forget a moment during the campaign. At the beginning, he was on the road with his stump, his dad, the bartender, you know, a lot of the stuff mm-hmm. he's still using today. And group by group, he was starting to move the needle among primary voters in Florida, but it's a huge state, big primary universe, happening slow. And he was kind of alone, wasn't raising a lot of money, behind in the polls. Crist had the apparatus. And he called me late at night one night. I was not doing the campaign. I was just supportive. And he was talking. They had offered him a deal to get out of the race. And it was one of these deals where, okay, Capone doesn't want the war anymore, so why don't you meet in a garage in the South Side at midnight, and we're gonna give you $1,000 and all is forgiven. I mean, you know there are eight guys with machine guns waiting in the garage. But Marco was thinking of taking the deal to run for a constitutional office because he didn't think he could win. And I'm having this conversation with him. I'm telling him, look, you spit in the eye of the boss. You got to either kill Charlie or he's going to kill you. There's no peace treaty. And by the way, I think you can win. You're a better primary candidate, but it's all going to move late like primaries do. Go, 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 fight, fight, fight. And which he ultimately did, and he won. But I could just see the calculating fear at that moment. And I thought from that moment on that he could be a good senator because he'd stand up for the right stuff. But he was, as a great old Paul once remarked about a particularly fearful congressman who was always hard to whip on votes. This guy is always the first to quiver and the last to vote. Ought to be his campaign slogan. And Marco was that guy. So I knew if he ran for president in the end, he would fold a lot and prevaricate and go with the wind. We actually had a weather vane ad about him that we ran to some good effect in Iowa. So the point being that Marco knows what to be, but he's never had the guts to really do it. He'll have a good day once in a while. And he's had some since Trump. But in the end, he's another guy rolled over and put the paws in the air because he has that weakness. That is his great flaw, that over-calculating lack of political. Sometimes you just have to get dumb, brave, and go. And Marco's never been able to do that. In the world of Trump with a super crazy alpha and Marco watching primary voter numbers saying, oh, this is bad for me. I got to get on the right side of this. He's going to be the first to quiver and the last to vote.
So to a certain extent, Trump has this superpower that he exposes everyone around him, that he's like kryptonite. Yeah. So he exposes the cynicism of Ted Cruz. You know, he exposes the opportunism of a Lindsey Graham. He exposes the weakness and the vacillation of a Marco Rubio. So at least that's a public service in some way. OK, I want to get your yeah. sense of the state of the race. OK. Where we're at now here with Bernie and Elizabeth and everybody. Have you seen David Brooks's column today that he's getting beat up about?
No, I have not. I should read it. Early in California, so I haven't.
He's basically saying that there's a fallacy of Bernie Sanders, that Bernie Sanders would be a disaster. He said, for Democrats, it's political suicide because he says class war progressivism always loses to culture war conservatism. Because swing voters care more about their values, things like guns, patriotism, abortion, masculinity, than they do about proletarian class consciousness. Do you agree with that?
I think American politics is much more a war about culture than class. Yeah. So I think Brooks is essentially right there. Mm-hmm. However, there's a Republican confirmation bias that's been rattling on for a year, which is all Republican psychology, at least in Washington, is, my God, can the Democrats actually nominate somebody worse than Trump so even Trump can win? Mm-hmm. And the Democrats have been fulfilling that bubble think in the Republican world, though I'm not sure it's true. I have no doubt that Elizabeth or Bernie are weaker candidates in a general election against somebody else. But Trump's numbers are not good. You know, this is something I keep saying. I won't bet my house Trump loses, but Trump, another thing he's done well is he's psyched out the entire Democratic Party, as well as obviously the Republican Party, that he has a magic Rasputin goat horn that he can blow in the middle of the night and some subliminal message goes out. And from the coastal Democratic elite point of view, you know, every redneck and hillbilly comes out like the Walking Dead to vote, and Trump can't be beat. Nate Silver said he was going to lose. He won. He's got that secret horn. He's Rasputin. The truth is, in every Republican election, except for maybe a Wisconsin Supreme Court race with low turnout, since Trump was inaugurated, the Republican candidate has done subpar. The range from a bit subpar to horribly subpar. We have lost control of 10 governorships. We've lost the House with 1974 Watergate-style losses. So this idea that Trump is this huge muscular political figure outside the Republican Party is a fallacy. Can Trump change and fix himself? No, or he wouldn't be, you know, bungling this impeachment politic. So I would not underestimate the fact that almost anybody can beat Trump. Although if I were a Democrat, I would have nominated Steve Bullock or Michael Bennett to minimize my risk. Instead, because they're in a big, you know, lost weekend of identity politics and cuckoo anti-corporate economics in their primary, they're going to take more risk than they ought to and give Trump the opportunity to make the election about somebody else. So, but I do think that Democratic socialist elites who think that we can finally have the big class struggle war are wrong. On the other hand, there is secret focus group data of Bernie and Elizabeth's anti-corporate message doing really well with Trump voters in the industrial Midwest. And so you can't underestimate the kind of butterfly of between crazy left-wing populism and crazy right-wing populism. They choose different artifacts to wave around, but the grievance energy behind them is similar. So I don't think the Bernie thing is impossible, and I think he is gaining in the primary now. So I think what's going to probably happen is out of Iowa, it's going to come down to Bernie versus somebody, maybe two people. And the big first question is, will Biden get wiped out and cause a mad scramble, or will it turn into Bernie v. Biden, or maybe Bernie v. Elizabeth and a Biden and or a Buttigieg? So we're going to have tremendous clarity into kind of the lanes of this race by the day after the New Hampshire primary.
Mike Murphy, thank you so much for joining me again on the Bulwark Podcast. I appreciate it very, very much, and we'll tune in to Hacks on Tap next week.
Oh, well, thank you, man. Always fun to do, and I look forward to rebuilding the Republican Party and conservatism with us merry few never Trumpers after this great national nightmare. A friend of mine is always joking, well, look at the bright side. You're like Toyota. All your factories will be destroyed in 1947, but you get to build new factories and beat everybody. So that day I am looking forward to.
All right. So thank you so much. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday and we'll do this all over again.